This is live. This is very exciting. Hello, everyone. Come and take a seat and make yourself at home. I think we're going to start. Terrific. Thank you. There are seats in the front, as usual. It's so funny how everybody always fills up the back rows and they kind of move themselves forward. But there's seats in the front if anybody needs a seat. Oh, great. Thank you, Ellen. Doesn't feel so daunting when their face is in the front. Greetings. Hello, everyone, and thank you for coming to the 13th Annual New York Society Library Book Awards Ceremony. I'm Connie Roosevelt. I'm the chairman of the jury. And needless to say, I want to start by thanking all of my jury members who are valiant, hardworking, and resourceful. They're listed on the inside of your program. We have one addition this year, one incredibly valuable addition. Susan Soros, who is director of the Bard Graduate School of Decorative Arts right across the park from us. It's always stunning to me how many books are written about New York City. It's about 100 to 200 books every year. I do not know how people are so resourceful as to find new things to write about in New York. This year we reviewed a book called The City's End, Two Centuries of Fears, Fantasies, and Premonitions About New York City's Destruction. One of the books that I reviewed was A History of Lighting in Times Square. You will be absolutely stunned to hear how interesting this book really was. One of the things I learned was that the first sign, the first lighted sign in Times Square, announced the winner of the 1902 presidential election, who was none other than Theodore Roosevelt. First sign. He was very good with the media. Anyway, for all that our list of books to review was very long this year, one of our winners was not even on it. Jury member Roger Paske found Trying Leviathan by Graham Burnett in the stacks quite when he was looking for something completely different. It turns out to be one of the more enlightening books on the intellectual history of New York City, but there it is. We were lucky to find it. Thank you, Roger. I'm not going to scoop your presentation, but it really is one of the great enlightening books on New York. A common theme of the awards this year is the Enlightenment and the serendipitous discoveries that are available in forgotten archives and collections. One of the masters of this is Lawrence Bergreen, my fellow library trustee and master of ceremonies for this. He is the author of 8 books, including biographies of Louis Armstrong, Al Capone, Irving Berlin, James Agee, and 2 accounts of the explorations of Magellan and, most recently, of Marco Polo. In fact, Larry's biography is so long, it's almost book length, and I'm going to commend you to his website, lawrencebergreen.com. So with that, Larry, do you want to come and take over?
Good evening, everyone, and thank you, Connie, for that beautiful introduction. I'm very, very glad to see you all here, probably more than you know, and especially on this very happy occasion of the New York City Book Awards, 13th Annual New York City Book Awards. The selections, I thought, were really exciting and stimulating, and I leapt on them, and I commend the jury for an excellent choice and winnowing through so many books to arrive at these 2 very different and very stimulating selections. I also want to thank Charles Berry, who I don't think is here tonight, who's chairman of the board of the library, and of course Connie again, and Jeanette Sanger, and our terrific librarian, Mark Bartlett, who does so much to make things work here. And the jury for all their hard work. If you've ever served as a jury, as a juror on a book award, you know it's a very difficult, it seems like it's going to be easy when you start, and it winds up being a difficult task to try and pick the 1 or 2 of the best ones. And of course I want to especially thank the authors of the books that we're going to be honoring this evening for their accomplishments. I was asked to say a few words about the importance of libraries and archives in our world. And speaking as someone who considers a library his native habitat, who's happier there than anywhere else, I was glad to do it. I think it's an enthusiasm we all share, and that's why we're here tonight. In researching and writing books over the past 25 years on a variety of different subjects, I've worked in libraries and archives all over the world, and they've been very different. Some of them were idiosyncratic beyond description. I remember working in the ancient Iran and India Trust on Magellan documents. This is at Cambridge University, and it was in a formerly private home. And if you can imagine a scene out of a John le Carré novel on a rainy day, and you walk into this house, which instead of having normal furniture was shelves of books in every room on every floor, but not just that, an endless supply of dogs who were wet and damp and somewhat smelly, wandering freely on all floors between all the bookshelves. Just imagine that here. And then a cast of characters who apparently, I wasn't sure if they lived there or they just visited there every day, who looked like they stepped out of a John le Carré novel. And then, of course, at 4 o'clock, and maybe they could consider doing this here, a little silver bell rang, and of course it was time for tea. And so we all sat down, and I discovered that many of the denizens of this library were Scottish, which meant we could not understand each other. Between their Scottish accent and my American accent, we just kept nodding at each other, nodding and smiling. Then there was the Mongolian National Library in Ulaanbaatar, where I was a couple years ago, 3 years ago, to do research on Marco Polo. What was most daunting about that library, which was actually fairly well organized, was that all the books and documents there were in either Mongolian or Uyghur, which are not languages that I know. So talk about the importance of librarians. If you think librarians are important here, of course there they were absolutely key to getting anything out of a library like that. And they were most welcoming and glad to have me there. They didn't get too many English-speaking people going through the library. But it was somewhat tough sledding. Now, each of these libraries, it seems to me, contains a kind of cultural and intellectual DNA, which is worth preserving and replicating at the same time, which is why we treasure libraries and value them so much, because each of them is unique, and they are a repository of human experience that is unlike anything else. I don't know about you, but when I walk into a library or an archives, you know, I don't feel or see piles of books or stacks of papers. I hear voices. I hear arguments. I hear people and endless quarrels and points of view and unresolved conflicts that go on and on and on and on. And as I get deeper into a subject, I'm able to hear more of these different points of view. And that's what's so seductive to me about libraries and archives. We are particularly lucky. I've been talking about faraway libraries, but here in the New York City area, to be absolutely overflowing with these repositories of DNA and these treasure troves. I'm sure you're aware uptown of the gorgeous Hispanic Society in Washington Heights, which not only has its very important bilingual collection of books, but it's Goya's, among other things. And I've done a great deal of very happy research at Columbia at Butler Library and its East Asian Library, which are also phenomenal resources and very easily accessible to ordinary members of the community like me. When I was working on Louis Armstrong, I became aware of the very pretty, very well-organized Institute for Jazz Studies at Rutgers, which was a short path train ride away from Manhattan, which is the leading jazz archives probably anywhere in the world. It probably even exceeds, although they'd hate to hear me say this down in New Orleans, it probably even exceeds anything down in New Orleans, although New Orleans has its share of very, very interesting and somewhat idiosyncratic jazz archives. However, for the past 40 years, I have considered this library, the New York Society Library, really my home library. It's been, for me, a library of first resort and of last resort whenever I was working on a book or some other project, partly because of the character of the library itself, its beautiful collection. It's fascinating special collections. It's extremely helpful staff. Its location, and partly because whenever I came here, even as a college student, I always received a warm welcome, and some librarian was able to take my request, no matter how far-fetched it might have been, take it seriously, and actually help me pursue it. So this particular library, I think, is one of the gems of New York City, as we all know, and I'm just absolutely thrilled to be associated with it. It does so many good things. Tonight's book awards are just one of many good works and good deeds that the library does on behalf of literature and writers and the community in general. And we're all very grateful. And I'm you know, very, very thrilled to just be associated with it and in any way at all. As you know, if you've used this library, it's also a window on other libraries around the world, around the city rather, and up and down the Eastern Seaboard through its interlibrary loan program. So it's, in a way, kind of many libraries in one, and all of them linked in this endless task of keeping our occasionally chaotic past up to date and relevant to our no less chaotic present. So anyway, without any further delay, I would like to let the awards themselves begin. And my congratulations to the winners. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Thank you.
So our first award is going to be presented by Betsy Barlow Rogers.
Good evening. How does a city preserve its history? And the answer is haphazardly. Luck plays a large role. In the case of the remarkable book of photographs by Eugene de Selignac, New York Rises, one piece of the luck came in the person of Michael Lorenzini, the curator of photography at the New York City Municipal Archives. Michael is himself a photographer of distinction, whose work has been exhibited at Sotheby's, the Bronx Museum, PS1, and the National Arts Club. Before he began his employment at the Municipal Archive 11 years ago, he was an assistant editor at Aperture Foundation, which publishes important books by contemporary photographic artists. We have people from Aperture here tonight, do we not? No, we're supposed to. oh, hello. Hi. it was Michael's sensibility and I as a photographer and photographic editor, as well as his archivist research skills that led to his important discovery of the man behind the camera in some of the most stunning photographs ever taken of this city. The added value of these remarkable images lies in the fact that they were made at the time when the city's bold infrastructure was being put in place, and as the book's title suggests, modern New York was rising out of the ground, or maybe out of the riverbeds. But these photographs would be works of art in any case. How could no one have known about them until now? An ordinary bureaucrat working in an obscure city agency, pardon me, Ken, a little known city agency, that should be better known, would not have had the visual acumen to examine closely a trove of glass plate negatives and discern that all were taken by a single individual. Nor would this imaginary bureaucrat have then had the curiosity to pursue with Sherlock Holmesian determination the name and story of Eugene de Selignac, the man behind the camera. Another piece of luck. It's very fortunate that the collection of over 10,000 glass plate negatives Zelenyak shot between October 5th, 1906 and May 31st, 1934 survive when so many other valuable documents and images have disappeared through fire, water damage, or storage in long forgotten locations. The original Central Park watercolor drawings were only discovered in the 1970s in a room in the Sarah Delano Roosevelt Recreation Center on the Lower East Side. And happily, these are now, they now reside in the Municipal Archive. What Michael saw and what you will see turning the pages of New York Rises is the Zelenyak's ability not only to document various bridges under construction, but also his ability to incorporate the human element, mostly the strong faces of working class men, but also street scenes and other parts of the urban panorama into complex and interesting compositions. Zelenyak has an extraordinary talent for framing space and also for capturing a typical and telling moment in the city's daily rhythm, such as the scene of men running to catch the Staten Island Ferry. The pictures speak for themselves, but Michael's clear, straightforward prose provides the background for our understanding of what they represent in the life of New York City. We have all these. I don't know what to do. Here is not only suitable for framing, but already framed.
Wow, that saves me a trip. Thank you.
There you go. You can present that for the camera.
All right.
And we also have for Kevin Moore. I don't believe Kevin can be with us today.
No.
Is Kevin with? No.
No.
All right. Would you? Make sure he gets that, or
somebody will.
Or should we the library will make sure that.
Yes,
somehow.
I think Nancy will.
Okay, we will do that. Okay, Nancy, would you please come up? And we have this award for you.
Thank you so much.
Couldn't happen to a nicer book and a nicer author.
Oh, that's so nice. Well,
it's a wonderful
publishing house. A great thing that you do.
Oh,
all right, and so this. Wait a minute. Did Aperture Foundation, it says on this one. Did we get confused here?
No. Who's going to take the one for Aperture?
Okay, Aperture. This is for the Aperture
Foundation. Oh, okay. I'm just going to take it.
Okay, you do that.
I'm just going to make a stack here.
All right. Make a stack. There are lots of them, right? And Ken,
you come up.
The Municipal Archives. Let's hear it for the New York Municipal Archives. And last is...
Oh, I think that's for the next one.
Oh, that is for the next one, yeah.
We won't take that one.
Is the next award.
All right. But I think am I supposed to give my little... Okay,
you're next. Okay.
I am next.
Right.
Thank you, Betsy.
You're
that
so
was
welcome.
Terrific. I'm not sure that I can add to it, but I'll try. I'm going to try not to repeat... a lot of things that are in my text. But since the book has been published, some further information has come to light on Eugene and his work. And I just want to talk a little bit about the discovery and what has come to light since. Tonight is perhaps the culmination of a journey that began back in 1999 when I discovered, as Betsy said, that this collection, which was one of the largest collections in the New York City Municipal Archives, was the work of one man. It's 20,000 glass plate negatives, 15,000 vintage prints. And I had made this discovery while trying to do research for another book of photography. I had come as an editor from Aperture. I came to this archive with, now we have over 2 million photographs. I was working part-time there as a printer, but with my editorial background, I thought, there's got to be a book of photographs in here somewhere. And I was planning on doing a book on city workers. And looking through this collection, I was sitting in front of 21 spools of microfilm of all the glass plate negatives, and I'd been going through it for weeks. And over, let's see if I know how to use this. Over the course of several weeks, I had seen not just these fantastic photographs of bridges, but iconic photographs of workers and the people who had built and served these monuments. And after several weeks of looking at these photographs, it just hit me one day, this guy was a great photographer. And I thought to myself, why did I think that? Why this guy? We had always assumed that this was a collection of photographs from many photographers over the years. But I knew that this was one eye. And looking at the logbooks, I was able to see the same handwriting for 30 years. And I went to Ken and said, I think I'm onto something. I think this is the work of one man. And we very easily from that point were able to look in our records and look at the payroll records for the city, the civil list. And sure enough, for 30 years, there was only one photographer listed. And his name was Eugene Desagnac. But that discovery happened very fast, but it took many years of research and a lot of diligence and luck for other things to come to light. And one of the things that bothered me when the book came out was there was all these unanswered questions. We didn't even know what this man looked like. We had never seen a photograph of him. I had managed to track down his granddaughter and his great-granddaughter, but they did not have a photograph of him. It was only after the book was published that I received an email from William Heater, who had read about the book in the Times of London. And he said, I am Eugene's grandnephew, and I have several photographs of the man. And this, then, is Eugene Desagnac. A handsome man, and by all accounts, very charming. he's been said to be a bit of a rake, and maybe that's why his marriage broke up. But he may not have ever become a photographer if it was not for this unhappy marriage. He came from a family of exiled French nobility. They were wealthy at one time, but now they were more middle class. And his wife, Eliza Cross, who showed up in the 1880 census as a clerk in a candy store, was actually the daughter of a wealthy confectioner from New York who had retired to Pompton Plains and ran a small candy shop out of their home. Lila's brother, John Francis Cross, was a painter, one of his paintings, and opera singer. He and Eugene were very close, and together with their other brother-in-law, Daniel Simpson, they were referred to in the family as the Terrible Three. Fondly, that is. In 1903, the Thaliac left Lila, who is remembered as a difficult and stern woman. The decision must have been difficult for Eugene because not only was he leaving his family, but he was also leaving his occupation. Since the birth of their second child, they had been running a boarding house, a family property, and now he was losing his wife, his family, his job, and his home. 43 years old, this man, Daniel Simpson, came to the rescue. He was the chief clerk and Eugene's brother, chief clerk of the Department of Bridges and Eugene's brother-in-law. And he came in and, according to the family lore, showed up one day with a camera and said, I have a job for you, Eugene. How hard can it be to learn to use one of these? Regardless of family lore, Simpson put Eugene up in his own home in New York and got him as the assistant to the photographer for the Department of Bridges. The photographer, Joseph Palmer, in 1906 fell ill and died. It was then that Eugene's handwriting first appears in the field logbook. A recently uncovered document shows that 2 years later, an application was filed with the Civil Service Administration stating that Eugene Desagnac, laborer, has requested to be given the photographer's practical exam for the civil service title of photographer. It was granted, and by 1909, he was made permanent photographer. And photograph he did, going out into the city with his camera and capturing the daily rhythms of the city. This is a cyanotype. And photographing right on through the Great Depression, still climbing up. Oh, oops, a little delay there. Still climbing to the top of these bridges when he was 71 years old. Eventually, in 1934, the city made him retire at the age of 72, and he died unheralded in 1943. That's, I think, a photograph of him probably about the year that he retired in 1934. Someone asked me recently if I could ever imagine at that moment back in 1999 where this project would lead. And my response was, actually, I knew immediately where this project would lead. I knew I had my book. I knew that it was going to be significant. But it took another 7 years to convince everybody else. But one of the first people I convinced was Leslie Martin at Aperture, who could not be here tonight. And my editor, Nancy Grubb, and Kevin Moore became true believers as well, and I'd like to thank them. But I've been so happy with the positive response to this book, worldwide response, I should say. And I'm so glad that people have shared my enthusiasm for Eugene and his work. Thank you.
I'm Roger Pasquier, and I'm going to do a brief presentation for the other award that we're giving this year for Trying Leviathan, which is by Graham Burnett, a professor at Princeton. And I wonder how many of you have ever been on jury duty, and I mean civil or criminal court, I don't mean a book jury, and how many of you have hoped for an interesting case, just as we hope for interesting books, and how many of you have thought, if you ever were on an interesting case, that it would be a great subject for a book and it would be fun to write that book? When I've been through those lines of thought, I've wondered why so few books about court cases from the juror's point of view ever have been written. So when a few years ago at Christmas, a kind friend gave me Graham Burnett's previous book, Trial by Jury, I was thrilled to see that somebody else had had the thought and carried it through to action. And it's a terrific book. And so when I saw that Professor Burnett had published another book and it had come to the library, I didn't find it by accident, Connie. I ran to the stacks to get it because I didn't care what it would be about. I knew it would be good. And so it wasn't that much of a surprise to discover that that was also about a trial. And because I knew how well Burnett had written about the trial on which he was the foreman of the jury, it wasn't a surprise to read that it was as though Burnett was actually in the jury, or covering the case as though he had been there in 1818, but he was at the same time also omniscient. Trying Leviathan is about a court case in 1818 about whether the whale was a fish. And this had come up as an economic question because the state legislature had recently passed a law saying that every barrel or every container of fish oil needed to be inspected. And there was a merchant who sold fish oil and whale oil, and when the inspector came and went through all the fish oil barrels, he said, well, what about those over there? And the merchant said, well, you don't need to go look at those. They're not fish oil. Well, they're whales. But no, that's not a fish. Well, most people thought that the whale was a fish and that these barrels needed to be inspected, and so it went to court in 1818. And aside from it being an immediate economic question, it also brought into play all kinds of other things that we are still thinking about today. It was a question of what was then called natural philosophy, since, as Professor Burnett reminded me recently, the word scientist hadn't been coined at that time. And it was a case of what is the feeling between the natural philosophers, the kind of scientific elite who were just coming into play in New York in 1818, versus the people? And what was the distinction between the kind of patrician group that controlled a lot of public opinion and the public institutions versus a popular culture? And the growing interest in having real experts rather than patricians or the popular culture determined what was really truth. And of course, it also inevitably involved religion, and it involved whalers, who were considered the authorities on whether the whale would be a fish. But as Professor Burnett shows in this book, they were divided. And of course, the trial foreshadowed Darwin and all of the controversy over evolution that would rise just a few decades later. And Professor Burnett also shows that this is a case that could only have taken place in New York. Farther east, in Connecticut and Massachusetts, the whalers had already determined what a whale really was. It was only in New York that there was room for doubt. So I'm not going to tell you what the jury determined in that case. But I will tell you that our jury considered several other history books this year. And this one came rather late into the field, but after some of my co-jurors read it, they acknowledged that the other history books that we had been enthusiastic about really paled in comparison with the elegance of Burnett's writing, the extraordinary range of the sources, and the kinds of research that he had done. He went through the jury records, of course, newspaper accounts, advertisements at the time, whaling logs, so that he saw firsthand what people who were on ships were thinking about whales. He had to refer to the Bible, of course, the encyclopedias of the time, and Herman Melville, without saying. Now, since this book has been published, Professor Burnett has won awards from coast to coast, from the New Bedford Whaling Museum to the Los Angeles Times. But I hope he will still think it means something to get an award from the New York Society Library, which is mentioned in the book, and of the various cultural institutions that were influential at the time, the library is the only one that still exists today. So unfortunately, Professor Burnett is in the Sea of Cortez right now with whales, making his own decisions. So we have the honor of having his wife here to accept this award.
Good evening. I'm going to say a few words, if that's okay. It's a great pleasure to join you here in this very special institution and on such a happy occasion as the honoring of my husband, Graham, and his book, Trying Leviathan, which your society has so graciously recognized with this year's New York Book Award. It broke Graham's heart not to be with us today. This, I can assure you, on the reliable basis of connubial intimacies. But as some of you know, Graham does not just write about whales as an historian of science and the environment. He also works for their protection, as Roger just mentioned, and the protection of their oceans and marine kin, fish or not fish. And it is therefore fitting, and perhaps even the occasion for a little joy on his behalf, that at precisely this moment, as I calculate it, time differences with Baja California being what they are, that he is almost certainly at the helm of a 21-foot panga cruising the Canal de Ballena off the Bahía de Los Ángeles, looking for fin, blue, and Brutus whales, and hopefully seeing some of them. With any luck, he and his colleagues from the Vermilion Sea Institute, a conservation-oriented nonprofit that runs classes and conducts research in marine ecology in Mexico, have the hydrophones in the water right now, and are listening to the screechy, wheezing, and clicks of a super pod of dolphins. I know very well how much this work means to him, and it is difficult for me to think of anything else that would keep him away from our gathering this evening. He asked me to read you a few words on his behalf, in his voice, so to speak, and I will do that now. Dear members of the New York Society Library, It is a great honor for me and for Trying Leviathan to receive the 2008 New York City Book Award for History. As you may have heard, my book deals with a curious trial in the early 19th century in this city, Maurice v. Judd was the name of the trial, in which a jury had to decide for the purpose of New York state law if a whale was a fish. I used the records of this trial to open out a larger story about science in the early republic and about changing ideas of natural order between Linnaeus and Darwin. What you may not know, however, was that your own august institution was, in a way, part of that story. Well, you just heard that, and now you're going to hear more. The star witness in my story, the learned Dr. Samuel Latham Mitchell, founder of the New York Academy of Sciences, and the expert witness for the new whale is not a fish taxonomy of the time, was a trustee of your library and used its collections regularly. It stands to reason that some of the ichthyological research he did to cram for his cross-examination was done in your stacks, and I was struck to discover that you currently hold not one, not two, but three copies of the pamphlet records of the trial, the largest single institution collection of any I know, and he knows them all. This fact alone suggests that your distinguished community of forebears, the 19th century members of the library, were entirely caught up in the citywide sensation occasioned by Maurice v. Judd. A last historical note. A central claim of my book is that the trial led in part to the downfall of the city's first, and in many ways, last effort to build a centralized intellectual institution, a kind of royal society for New York. It was a model of the relationship between science and democracy that would not survive, but it glimmered for a moment in the first decades of the 19th century in the New York Institution, a vast building adjacent to the new City Hall, where all of the city's learned societies were for a time gathered. The Museum of Natural History, the Historical Society, together with societies of chemistry and natural history, and so forth. All but one, interestingly, yours. The New York Society Library was offered a space in the new institution, but your prescient early leaders smelled a rat. Or to put it differently, they sensed that Americans, or New Yorkers anyway, were not going to be sympathetic to this model of taxpayer-supported philosophy and culture as a pillar of the polity. The Society Library already had its own building and its own coterie of philanthropic supporters, and it respectfully withdrew from what would ultimately be a sinking enterprise, choosing to go it alone instead. We are the better for their wisdom, since many of those early learned societies that threw in with the fate of the New York Institution foundered at its failing. So please join me in spirit in raising a glass to your founders and sage leaders who sensed back in 1818, shall we say, the dangers of a Leviathan breaching in Lower Manhattan. Yours sincerely, Graham.
Well, I, for one, have learned a lot with these acceptances. Thank you so much. That's fascinating, and I hope that we can actually send that out to our members. I think they'd all be interested. Thank you all for coming. This was terrific. It's always a challenge and a great joy to find winners for this award, and I think that this year we've really done it again. Thanks a lot to all of you.